Casanova was immediately taken with England. Its roads, its carriages, its people, for all they think they are superior to everyone else. He found a large townhouse on London's Pall Mall, with much admired water closets in every bedroom. It was not, however, where Casanova had intended to stay. He had assumed he would be welcomed as a favoured house guest at the home of Mrs. Teresa Cornelis, London's premier club hostess. She was a childhood friend, and Teresa and he had a 10-year-old daughter, Sophie, conceived back in 1753, while Casanova was in the middle of a torrid affair with a young convent girl. However, although he made straight for Carlyle House, he was not welcomed with open arms. The years had not been kind to Teresa. She was now 40 and getting stout, but the girl next door in San Samuele had become a woman of style, fashion and substance, making several fortunes in the new business of running what amounted to a private club in her lavish house on Soho Square. There was a craze in London for Venetian-style masquerades or ridotti, and access to Teresa's parties were strictly guarded by society ladies. Teresa invited him to the last ball of the season and told Casanova he could come as her son's tutor and her friend, even though he was not an aristocrat. Casanova claimed he only bore the insult in the hope of being allowed to spend time with his daughter. Teresa suspected rightly that Casanova wanted access to her friends for the purpose of setting up a state lottery, as he had done so successfully in France, but Teresa was disinclined to help. Casanova returned to Carlyle House for a dinner that was to include his daughter. He took a sedan chair from his house on Pall Mall, in the company of a footman called Jarby he had hired because he was both fashionably black and also trilingual, and wore his most expensively foppish Parisian lace. The company was duly impressed. Teresa, however, had instructed her daughter to greet Casanova with cold formality, and Casanova spent a tortuous evening trying to persuade the embarrassed girl to talk to him. Yet he kept all of his life a note from her, written in French, on paper which she had lined for the purpose. It expressed formal thanks for a present. Casanova went back and forth to the city to try to sell his plans for a lottery. He saw Garrick at Drury Lane. He met and spoke to Queen Charlotte, met Dr. Johnson, and went to Ranelagh the Rotunda in Chelsea, where society and the demi-monde met for dances and flirtations, and where he praised the simple bread and butter, tea and lemonade. And Casanova loved to eat. At every inn, ballroom or ridotto, he recalls in his memoirs what he put into his mouth, from Parisian ices, London's beer, oysters in Naples, to Corfu confit. He gives one recipe for long lovemaking, warning a mistress that he was in danger of exploding with desire because he had eaten a cup of chocolate and the whites of fresh eggs. Casanova was at once wildly impressed by British produce, and somewhat less so by the ability of chefs to deal with it. English meals were like eternity, he complained. They had no beginning or end. His French-educated palate missed soup, which London taverns in the 1760s considered an effete Parisian extravagance. Nevertheless, he noted that the bagnios of London, the brothels of St. James's that prefigured the gentlemen's clubs later in the century, served excellent food. Though Casanova famously described the sex trade in London as the most sophisticated in Europe and a bargain deal, bed, bath and bedmate, a magnificent debauch, it paled for him after a while, and he sought more fulfilling affairs. Not before, however, he had sampled the available charms of the infamous Garrick sisters, and even been offered a quickie with Kitty Fisher, London's most renowned courtesan, covered with diamonds to the value of 500,000 francs, and awaiting a royal duke. Casanova declined because they had no language in common. Love without language is an ugly business. Casanova's History of My Life is also a unique record of the 18th century's attitude to fertility, mostly to the business of avoiding unwanted pregnancy. He writes about condoms as the most important tool in allowing his partners to relax, and made his lovers laugh with his euphemisms. redingotes d'Angleterre or English riding coats, the coat that gives peace to one's heart, even writing a verse about them. Yet he fathered 8 children he knew of, while thanking his redingote d'Angleterre that he did not see his own visage more often across Europe. Italian operas, Jewish painters, multilingual African servants, Casanova sketches a diverse cosmopolitan London, so it is not surprising he came upon other continental economic migrants he had met before. Casanova had known Marie-Anne Chapillon, a French-Swiss courtesan, in Paris, and now reacquainted himself. She was young, doe-eyed, with abundant chestnut hair, and those admired attributes of the age, exquisite hands and feet. Marie-Anne was set on a career as London's premier grande horizontale, and had little time for Casanova. Perhaps she sensed what he had only begun to guess, that beneath his dazzlingly confident carapace, something more vulnerable was emerging. A man who recognized the ridiculousness of his position, his self-aggrandized fantasy. And she sensed her power to mock his sexual prowess at the moment when it was turning from its full tide. "I knew," he declared melodramatically, "that aged 38 I had begun to die." He invited her to his house. As it happened, some members of her extended family owed Casanova money. Marie-Anne made it clear that she expected to be set up as his mistress in a fine establishment in Chelsea. There must be a stipend and servants. To all this, Casanova agreed. A contract was produced by Marie-Anne's mother, her madame, who received 100 guineas from Casanova as down payment. However, Marie-Anne decided to ignore key aspects of the contract. She did not want to sleep with Casanova. After a few days, it made some sense. Her family wanted Casanova to return the proof that they owed him more than 4,000 livres. Marie-Anne said he could sleep with her if he gave up the bills of exchange. He did so. She wept with gratitude. They retired to bed, but she denied him again. For Casanova, it was an unfamiliar experience. In the Tudor maze at Hampton Court Palace, she again pulled away, and in a moment of madness he instantly regretted, Casanova threatened Marie-Anne with his penknife. Then he got up, retrieved his hat and walking stick, and they proceeded back into more open public spaces, assuming the air of lost tourists. They returned to London. Casanova demanded the return of his bills of exchange. The family refused, and said they would consider returning them through Marie-Anne once Casanova had learned to respect her. Soon after, Marie-Anne, diagnosed with what was considered a life-threatening stress-induced interrupted period, took to her bed, demanded £10 from Casanova for doctor's fees, and put out to Soho that she would soon die as a result of his violence. Her health deteriorated rapidly, and within a few days Casanova heard that Marie-Anne was not expected to live. "At that moment," he wrote, "I felt as it were an icy hand clutching my heart." He returned to Pall Mall convinced that he was responsible for the early death of a woman he loved and set about putting his affairs in order. He put his diamonds, snuff boxes, purses, money and portfolios into a strong box to be discovered after his death. Then he went out in his sturdiest overcoat, bought lead shot with which to load his large pockets, and walked to the Thames. He went to Westminster Bridge, and there he contemplated the grey waters. He felt old and ill-judged. He may also have been suffering an early bout of his later recurrent depression, symptomatic of syphilis and its companion psychosis, blue devils. Casanova alludes to the great treatment or mercury cure he underwent at this time. As the lead weighed in his pockets, he was interrupted by a friend. It was Sir Welbore Ellis Ager, the playboy son of a minor MP who thought he knew exactly what Casanova needed. A drink, a woman, beef and Yorkshire pudding. Casanova agreed to eat some oysters, foregoing sex with 2 naked French dancers, and a drink helped to some extent. He then agreed to go with Sir Welbore to Ranelagh Rotunda, leaving his pistols and his lead weights at the Cannon pub, and headed for Chelsea, saying he would pick them up the next morning and kill himself. He never did. At the Rotunda, dancing among a crowd of admirers and wearing a dress he had given her, he saw Marie-Anne. She bolted. Casanova took the only revenge left to him. He bought a parrot, which he left at the city's Royal Exchange, only once he had taught it to say, "Mademoiselle Chapillon is more of a whore than even her mother." Casanova crossed the Channel in a mercury and syphilis delirium, and after several days in Calais, he limped on, ill, bankrupt, and at a loss what to do next. He pressed on to Berlin, and the prospect of an interview with Frederick the Great of Prussia. The Seven Years' War, concluded in 1763, had cost Prussia dearly, and Casanova was among many who thought they might profit from its rebuilding. Casanova was an enthusiastic supporter of Frederick's politics and military prowess. He wrote a scurrilous poem in his honour, eulogising the king's sequestration of Silesia by personifying the country as a woman desperate to be taken by her rampant monarch. When Casanova read it to a cardinal, who knew the king better, he laughed for 10 minutes at the idea. Casanova dressed in black and attended the king in the gardens of Sanssouci, his pleasure palace outside Potsdam. Frederick was, as usual, in military uniform. Initially, the conversation was stilted. When the king mistook him for a hydrologian, Casanova thought he might have to parry his small knowledge of fountains into a pitch for work, but the subject of a lottery was raised, and Frederick remarked to him that he thought a lottery was a tax on stupidity. As he was leaving the gardens, Frederick had turned to Casanova, looked him up and down, and then, after thinking for a moment, said, "You're a very fine figure of a man." Frederick the Great may or may not have been a practicing homosexual. Voltaire made jibes at his expense, and the British ambassador had noted his unnatural tastes. Casanova affected to be a little shocked. He had thought he was being taken rather more seriously. 5 or 6 weeks later, the king offered Casanova a job as tutor to the new Academy of Officer Cadets. Casanova seems to have taken offence at this, too. In his memoirs, he describes the barracks as Spartan, the wages insulting, the post minor, though, in truth, the cadet school was to be an exclusive and royally favoured institution. Casanova, wary of official posts that might involve too much hard work, turned it down. There is a point in a self-made or self-fantasized career when it is harder, perhaps, to face cold financial and professional realities than to struggle on in the dream that some huge win will redeem all past losses and failures. Casanova, gambler, spendthrift, internationalist, and dilettante, was faced with such a moment, and chose to press on to the new city of St. Petersburg.